And now, from the most macro of economic indicators to the most micro.
I'm about to make the last payment on my $17,000 of debt so that I'll be out of credit card debt.
Right now.
Right now, yeah.
That's Rachel Wilson talking with her friend and our producer, Zoe Chase. You might remember Rachel. She was on the show a few months back, just before Congress passed a credit card reform bill. Zoe checked in with her this week.
This was Rachel's life 2 years ago when she owed $17,000 to about 20 different card companies.
I couldn't sleep at night, and I just had this kind of constant anxiety about it. And I would say, okay, that's it. Like, I am not going to, you know, spend any more on my credit cards. One time I froze my credit cards in a block of ice so I couldn't use them.
In October of 2008, as the government bailed banks out of their bad debt, Rachel started her own bailout program. She wrote down every single expense on her blog, and she put a big chunk of her paycheck towards her credit cards every month. When I visited her in April, she was only $3,000 away from being credit card debt free.
So I'm logging in to my account.
July 15th, 2009. Bank earnings are up, stock market stabilizing, yeah, and that. Rachel...
By selecting OK, you're authorizing an electronic withdrawal to pay your credit card. So I'm going to click OK. And there we go. Yeah, so now I am out of credit card debt.
So how do you feel, Mia?
I'm a little scared, actually, because now I'm supposed to start saving all of this money that I've been putting towards my credit cards, and it seems like it would be really easy to not do that. I can literally do anything I want, which is terrifying.
That's a terrifying spot a lot of us would like to be in.
That's NPR's Zoe Chase.
The White House is denying accusations that the health overhaul bills moving through Congress now would actually increase health spending over the long haul. Congressional Budget Office Director Douglas Elmendorf touched off the dispute with this comment Thursday.
We do not see the sort of fundamental changes that would be necessary to reduce the trajectory of federal health spending by a significant amount.
That's just about the last thing Democrats on Capitol Hill wanted to hear. So President Obama is stepping in to try to make certain the effort stays on track. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
CBO Director Elmendorf's comments were widely interpreted to mean that the plans would increase the federal deficit over the next 10 years. That's not true. But what he was really saying was perhaps more disappointing to lawmakers crafting the bills, that the measures wouldn't slow the nation's total health spending in the long run and might, in fact, increase federal spending. And in any case, the political damage was done. President Obama hastily scheduled an appearance to reassure lawmakers that cost-cutting remains his top priority.
Let me repeat. Health insurance reform cannot add to our deficit over the next decade. And I mean it.
The administration also sent to Congress its own legislative proposal to aid in the cost-cutting goal, its first formal contribution to the health care effort. The idea is based on one that's already been floating around on Capitol Hill for the past several weeks. It would significantly beef up the power of an existing agency known as the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, or MedPAC. Here's how the president described it.
Every year, there's a new report that details how much waste and inefficiency there is in Medicare, how best practices are not always used, and how many billions of dollars could be saved. Unfortunately, this report ends up sitting on a shelf.
Under the president's plan, MedPAC, or a new independent board just like it, would come up with a set of payment recommendations for health care providers, which the president and Congress could approve or reject, but not amend. If the commission was ordered to find savings, the process would clearly bend the cost curve, as the phrase goes, on health spending. But there's one big problem. Congress likes to decide Medicare payments itself. There are hospitals and doctors in every single congressional district, and adjusting payment levels is a popular form of congressional pork. So giving that payment power to outsiders hasn't sat well with people like Senate Republican moderate Olympia Snow of Maine.
I think people ultimately expect the Congress to weigh in and be accountable, and will be held accountable. And just doing an up and down vote without ever having you know, alternative proposals and modifications, I think would be very difficult.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi didn't seem too thrilled with the idea either at her news conference yesterday.
We tasked the staff to figure out how we could come together so that we get the savings, but the responsibility of Congress would be reflected in the criteria we put forth and that the administration can have what they want.
In other words, it's always the same old story with Congress. Spending money is easy. Cutting spending is hard. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News.
NASCAR has spent years trying to break free from its hillbilly caricature. Despite some rough patches because of the current recession, NASCAR still reigns as the second most popular TV sport after football. Now, though, comes a drug scandal involving one of NASCAR's drivers, Jeremy Mayfield. He recently tested positive for methamphetamine, his second positive test, and that's only the beginning. Here with the rest of the tale is Ryan McGee. He broke the story of Mayfield's first positive drug test this past spring for ESPN the magazine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Mr. McGee, first off, give us a little background on Jeremy Mayfield. Who is he?
Jeremy, he's your classic NASCAR success story. He grew up in Owensboro, Kentucky, which has always produced great NASCAR talent. And Jeremy was the last person to come out of Owensboro, came to Charlotte, landed a ride with NASCAR legend Cale Yarborough, and has won 5 Sprint Cup Series races, and a very likable guy. And that's why, quite honestly, this last chapter of his career has been such a shocker.
Well, what happened to him this past spring?
Jeremy turned 40 just recently, which in NASCAR is kind of the golden number. Once you hit 40, it seems like, you know, history says that's the backside of your career as opposed to the ascent. Coming into the 2009 season, he wasn't able to secure a ride with the full-time Sprint Cup Series team, so he started his own. It was this great kind of story that the fans clung to, which was a man that just said, you know what, I'm going to do it myself. He had a lot of volunteers working on the team, building his own race cars. It was kind of a throwback story. And then he tested positive, failed his drug test the first weekend of May. The following weekend, NASCAR announced the suspension. No one knew what he had tested positive for, and then eventually we learned that it was methamphetamine.
And he recently tested positive for this again. He is denying this, but at the same time, his stepmother has come out saying that she has seen him use methamphetamine on at least 30 occasions.
That's where this entire story has taken a Jerry Springer turn, and it's just has happened in the past week. Certainly it was being tried in the court of public opinion. There was a huge line, a dividing line in the grandstands at the racetrack. Some thought he was guilty, some thought he wasn't. Same could be said for the garage where the people that work within the sport, some jumped to Jeremy's defense, but the vast majority behind closed doors, they would say they thought he was guilty or they just didn't want him on the racetrack. You know, NASCAR is like the circus. It's the only sport where everybody packs up and goes to the next town, and it's the same group of people. Team owners, sponsors, NASCAR officials, media members, crew members, you know, other drivers, crew chiefs. It's really a very small, very tight-knit community, and everyone knows what everyone else is doing. And, you know, there are rumors and there's truth, and, you know, it really is just like being back in high school.
So is Mayfield's career over? I mean, does he have any future in stock car racing?
No, he doesn't at all. And he himself has started to admit that, you know, this week.
Mr. McGee, I understand you used to work for NASCAR. How big of a deal is the Mayfield case for NASCAR, a sport that has really been trying to work on its reputation as a kind of a suburban lifestyle sport?
Yeah, and when I worked for the league, it was a very deliberate, it wasn't malicious, but it was a very deliberate plan, which was bringing in new fans. It wasn't necessarily cutting ties with the old fans, but it was bringing in, you know, housewives, and it was bringing in white-collar businessmen, and it was bringing in people from the West Coast and people from the Northeast that don't necessarily come from a car culture. Part of that was trying to put some distance between itself and the old school, you know, Southeastern, you know, fair or unfair, redneck image of the sport. And that's why this hurts so much, because you certainly couldn't come up with more of a redneck situation, quite honestly, than a driver from Kentucky testing positive for methamphetamines and doing it twice, and now dragging the whole stepmom and some of the things that he said in public. So, you know, whether he's guilty or innocent at this point, you know, the league is scrambling a little bit to make sure that, you know, the perception isn't that it's like this with everybody in the garage, because quite honestly, it's not.
That's Ryan McGee of ESPN, the magazine. Mr. McGee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And America's community colleges have seen a boom in enrollments thanks to the recession. At Houston Community College, some of that growth comes from students who travel halfway around the globe. The school already has the nation's highest percentage of foreign students, and as NPR's Larry Abramson reports, it's trying to export its success overseas.
Even if there were any ivy on the walls of Houston Community College, it would wither in the Houston heat. The drab buildings of the school's Galton campus are typical community college architecture. But that doesn't scare anyone away.
Did you understand it?
Yes.
Some students stare blankly at teacher Catherine Chirinos during her intensive English class, but some pipe up constantly with answers.
Because the person is not able to remember his wife's name and the children's.
That's funny if you can't remember your nice name, right?
One of the brightest bulbs in the class is Sajal Desai. She came here after HCC's fame spread via word of mouth to the small city she comes from in India.
I heard about it back in India also, because one of my cousins who was studying here in this community college.
Once her English is up to snuff, Desai wants to study nursing. She's 41 years old, and her parents need help. She says that at home, higher education is reserved for the top students.
Generally, they give admission to the fresh students. And here in the United States, we are having opportunity to study English.
Desai is one of 4,000 foreign students here, some fresh off the plane and still struggling. Their parents want them to be here so badly, some are spending the equivalent of the family fortune on expenses. Affluent, high-scoring students have long rushed to American four-year schools. Teacher Christine Tierney says she has to keep reminding herself that her students are different.
We don't get always the best and the brightest. We have to remember who it is that we are teaching and why we are here.
If HCC's growth is impressive, the stories of students placing all their bets on an American education are often breathtaking.
This is my name, Tony. My Vietnamese name is Tong.
Tony Pham is a cherub-faced 23-year-old who's only been in the States for about a month. I met him for a dinner of pho in one of the countless Vietnamese shopping malls on Houston's Bel Air Boulevard. Even though Tony went to college in Vietnam, his parents decided to spend $1,800 a semester on ESL courses, but they are convinced that an American degree will help buy him a successful career as a pharmacist.
The United States has a good education, a lot of school, a good school.
Tony is part of a recent boom of students from Vietnam, drawn in part by the large Vietnamese community already in Houston. After we eat, Tony shows me around the mall. He translates one of the schmaltzy Vietnamese torch songs that serve as muzak.
A woman wake up with her boyfriend. And she feels it's hard to forget him.
What are Tony's chances for success? Houston Community College has no statistics on how well the growing cadre of foreign students actually do as a group, but there are many success stories that help lure newcomers.
This is like the latest stuff going on.
Samira Faridi got her degree in fashion design from HCC in 2004. Today, she owns Poshak Fashion and Style, located on a busy corner in southwest Houston. It is full of the flowing silk gowns and tunics favored at weddings by the city's Pakistani and Indian communities. Lately, Faridi says there's been a boom in demand by Westerners for Bollywood weddings, thanks to a recent Oscar-winning film.
Yes, all the ethnicities. They're here. They want to wear something or somehow to do with the style that the girls are wearing in Slumdog Millionaire. So.
HCC welcomes these students for many reasons. One is money. Foreign students pay three times as much as local residents on tuition. Houston Community College does not recruit directly overseas, officials say, but the school ensures that word of mouth will spread the school's name thanks to the development of Saigon Tech. This privately run school is the brainchild of one immigrant who returned home with the dream of starting a community college-style school for his countrymen. HCC helped the school develop an approved curriculum, and today...
It's the only Vietnamese school that's fully affiliated with an American community college, fully accredited.
Gigi Doe is in charge of HCC's international efforts. She's a stylish, energetic woman who's so busy I could only catch up with her in an airport lounge as she ended a trip to the Middle East. There, she's trying to set up another collaborative relationship, helping the Saudis develop an HCC-style school in Riyadh.
So therefore, once again, we are the pioneers. As we did with the Saigon in Vietnam, now we're going into the Middle Eastern part of the world.
Of course, HCC will be paid by the Saudis, money that will help the school deal with growing demand at home and from abroad. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The most trusted man in America has died. That's a factually verifiable lead. Walter Cronkite, the face of CBS News in its greatest days and the definitive anchorman, died last night at his apartment in New York. He was 92. He saw Americans through assassinations, wars, and moonshots. For nearly two decades, tens of millions of Americans tuned in to watch him deliver the nightly news with his famous sign-off, "That's the way it is." NPR's David Folkenflik has this appreciation.
It's been more than a generation since Walter Cronkite left the anchor's desk of the CBS Evening News, and at the time of his death, he was still known by many as Uncle Walter, the ultimate reliable source, the nation's narrator, and the standard by which all other TV news anchors are judged. Take the horrific news he confronted just 19 months into the job. Cronkite rushed to air and calmly led viewers through terrible tragedy with simple, declarative sentences.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Cronkite choked up on camera ever so briefly as he took off his reading glasses to check the time.
It was a very effective moment, and it's been rerun 1,000 times.
Longtime Cronkite friend Andy Rooney of CBS.
If Walter had had his choice, he would have suppressed those tears because he hated to reveal himself as an emotional person.
Yet ultimately, Cronkite's composure and mastery throughout the day and those that followed inspire no little awe even now. Retired CBS News foreign correspondent Tom Fenton.
The old joke, you know, the secret in this business of broadcast news is credibility. If you can fake that, you got it made. But Walter didn't have to fake it.
As a young reporter for the United Press Wire Service, Cronkite covered the combat of World War II up close and was later hired by Edward R. Murrow for CBS. He became anchor of the CBS Evening News in 1962, and it expanded to a half hour. Cronkite loved perfecting what he called the magic, the 6 minutes a night that he was visible on the air delivering the news, endlessly polishing his copy and timing his delivery for what became the company's top-rated newscast. Television was newly dominant, and there were few competing distractions back then. Yet Andy Rooney says network executives often pushed for softer stories as they brought entertainment values to their news divisions.
But Walter didn't care. He was absolutely in favor of giving the American people what they needed to know, not what they wanted to hear.
From the outset, Cronkite put his own editorial stamp on coverage. Tom Fenton says Cronkite had privately been a strong supporter of American involvement in Vietnam.
It was only after that famous trip that he made to Vietnam and he saw the reality on the ground and heard what was really going on that he came to what for him was the inescapable conclusion.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe in the face of the evidence the optimists who have been wrong in the past.
Unlike the punditry that dominates nighttime cable news shows, Cronkite's nightly newscasts were so measured that the contrast made this editorial in February 1968 after the Tet Offensive all the more powerful.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
President Lyndon Johnson instantly got it. When he saw that newscast, he turned to his press secretary, George Christian, and said, quote, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country." But there was good news, too, and Cronkite took great joy in delivering it.
Armstrong is on the moon, Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon. On this July 20th, 1969.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Cronkite devoted hours to the space program, but made news again when he devoted 14 minutes of his newscast in October 1972 to a single topic, Watergate, even though President Nixon would breeze to re-election a few weeks later.
But the episode grew steadily more sinister. No longer a caper, but the Watergate affair, escalating finally into charges of a high-level campaign of political sabotage and espionage, apparently unparalleled in American history.
CBS wasn't breaking news here, but Cronkite had assembled a team of reporters to explain the affair fully to a much larger public and to ensure the matter couldn't be dismissed. Cronkite once described his approach on NPR's Diane Rehm Show.
The ethic of a responsible journalist is to put his or her biases, his or her prejudices aside in an attempt to really be fair to all sides at all times. And my pride is that I think I did that fairly well during my years.
Cronkite retired in 1981, but he expected to hold a senior role at the network during the Dan Rather era and was hurt to learn there was no room. He did some work for Discovery, NPR, and the History Channel, devoted more time to sailing, and reemerged as the voice of CBS News, if only to introduce Katie Couric when she took over as anchor. More than a generation later, Walter Cronkite's rumbling voice still echoes. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
And if you go to our website, npr.org, you can hear some of the essays that Walter Cronkite did for NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. And, of course, we're going to review the week's news with Dan Shore. But we want to ask Dan now to begin by talking about his old friend and colleague of so many years at CBS News, Walter Cronkite, who died last night at the age of 92. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
And what was he like?
Well, he was very matter-of-fact and very collegial and very easy to work with, tried very hard to be neutral and very dispassionate. Sometimes succeeded and sometimes not. As, for example, when President Kennedy was killed, there was a tear in his eye and there was a break in his throat. And when he went to Vietnam and came back and said that war is unwinnable, that had an enormous effect. Other than that, simply easy to be with because he was a true professional.
And his legacy?
His legacy, I guess, is the legacy of the one who used to be called Uncle Walter by many people. And that is to say that he was a man that was trusted more than any person in the United States. His legacy is that there was a time when people told us things and we believed them and trusted them inherently. Nowadays, however, is he right, is he wrong, or whatever, the legacy of Walter Cronkite was trust.
Turning now to other news this week, the Obama administration found that the momentum it had going on health care reform was blunted this week when the Congressional Budget Office warned that the plans coming out of the House were going to be significantly more expensive than had been projected. President Obama called a press conference on Friday afternoon to talk about that. What are the options they're weighing now?
Well, there apparently is trouble. And apparently, it, as you said, has lost a certain amount of its momentum. It's not only that Elmendorf of the Congressional Budget Office says that it really doesn't achieve savings and cut costs House, and that headline wasn't very helpful. It's also that in the Senate, it bogged down and was put over to next week, which raises the question of whether the president can have what he wants to have, is to have a bill before August. That now begins to become in question just from the loss of time.
What does the administration do in response?
Well, the first thing that the president did was to do what he would not normally do on a Friday afternoon, which is to come out a half hour after he said he would come out and say, we're really doing very well. It's achieved a great deal of consensus and all of that. He reminded me a little bit of a coach in a locker room when things aren't going well and giving a pep talk. It was a pep talk saying, whatever you may read in the headlines about trouble, so on and so on, it ain't so. We're nearly there. Just hang on.
Ted Van Dyke, the old Democratic operative who worked for Hubert Humphrey and in the Johnson White House, had a op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal this week in which he suggested that President Obama was spending his political capital by making maybe too many public appearances. Is that the case?
Well, it is his way. He does make a great many appearances, and that's the way he likes to govern. Yes, and we're about to start talking about another of his appearances.
Of course, the president was addressed the NAACP convention this week, and what an extraordinary image of the first African-American president speaking at the 100th anniversary of this country's oldest civil rights organization.
Right.
How do you assess what the president said?
Well, it really was quite dramatic, as it had to be. But what impressed me most of all was that the president kept talking about not what's happened in the first 100 years of the NAACP, but the road ahead, mm-hmm. what still needs to be accomplished, the needs of education, the needs for people to take responsibility. And it was very interesting. Here was these veterans of the civil rights marches and all saying, look where we are. We got a president in the White House. And the president said, yeah, but on my shoulders, you've got to go ahead and let's get the rest of it done.
President's nominee to the Supreme Court, Judge Sonia Sotomayor of New York, finished up several days of confirmation hearings this week.
Mm-hmm.
Any doubt she'll be confirmed?
Well, all the people who should know say they're on their own. No one has come out to say there won't be a filibuster. That's out of the question. As to whether there'll be votes against her, there may be a few. But from every appearance, she pretty well has it done.
Do we learn anything about the judge that surprised you or was interesting during this week of hearings?
She was just, I expected her to be, very cool, very self-possessed, knew exactly what she was doing. And I think she will bequeath, as a result of that, about three words which will be remembered forever. One is wise Latina, yeah. And the other is empathy. Those are the words which became the words that's threaded through the hearings. But other than that, I think she's made it.
Some surprising news out of Wall Street this week, I guess. Several banks posted better than expected earnings. Bank of America, Citigroup, which just a few months ago were getting bailout money,
yes.
Seem to be doing quite well now. Now, does this suggest to you that the bailouts worked or that they so far have worked for the banks but maybe not the taxpayer?
Well, nobody seems really to know, even experts on this, of which I certainly am not, can't be quite sure. They didn't expect it to happen. It was a better quarter than they expected it to be. They didn't know why. Would it have been not as good? Would it have been worse if it hadn't been for the bailouts and so on? We don't know, or at least let me frankly tell you that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very interesting that the bonuses are still being paid.
Secretary of State Clinton gave a foreign policy speech this week at the Council on Foreign Relations just before heading off to India. You were there. What did she say?
Well, she gave a pretty good what they call tour d'horizon, the tour of the horizon of the whole foreign policy, very carefully, very well done. The only thing that struck me as rather interesting was her discussion of relations with Iran. Here's Iran, whose government now may not be legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she's holding the door open to conversations with them. She will never say, for example, we will not deal with this one, which probably stole the election, and we won't deal with them. And I think it's very important at this point, because I think that Iran is getting into a very polished state. Then Rafsanjani, the former president, getting up and making a speech attacking the present regime, a sense that there were demonstrations still going on, which they seemed to be unable to control. And it may well be, without our having done very much about it, that Iran may be in such great trouble itself that it may be in the near future doing less trouble for others.
Thanks very much, Dan Shore.
Sure thing.